When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
The beauty of remote viewing is that it provides objective evidence that we really are more than just our brains, that humans are capable far more than just what physical scientists claim we are capable of. And remote viewing is really, really strong evidence for that.
Paul H. Smith, remote viewer, and remote viewer with prestige, because you were affiliated with, the everybody knows him, the Stargate program that was working with the Army, and from day one, or almost day one, you were associated with people like Ingo Swann, very well-known Pat Price. I wanted to interview you because you're also part of the book that's just been released, Frederick Atwater, and this is Skip Atwater, Project 8200. Mm-hmm. The original remote viewing transcripts, UFO, UAP, bases and activities. This is dynamite. And you had talked about this before back in 2018, kind of alluding to some of this, because I don't think all of it had been really accessible. I think Hal Puthoff had some information on it. You had some. And it was something that wasn't actually run up the chain. And so it hadn't been, shall we say, deep sixed. Which something else might have been. So, okay, I want you to tell the story. For one, how did you get involved in the remote viewing program and why? And then from there, we'll get into the stuff that went on in regard to the UFOs, UAPs, and stuff with the Project 8200. How's that?
Okay, well, how did I get involved and why?
Yeah.
Well, the why didn't have anything to do with me exactly. The Army had, particularly the Army Intelligence Security Command, which was at that time commanded by a two-star general named Bert Stubblebine. They were running the remote viewing program. And at that time, I had never put the words remote and viewing together. I had got back from Europe doing a three-year tour with the Special Forces over there as their intelligence officer. And gone through an Army school and got transferred to Fort Meade, Maryland, where it turns out this program was. So there I am at Fort Meade. I was doing a Mideast analyst job because Middle East was kind of my specialty. And I had not realized it, but I had been, the Army had assigned me quarters next door to Skip Atwater and across the street from Tom McNair, who was a remote viewer in training. So I make friends with these guys. They're nice folks, but they were a little weird because they wore civilian clothes and Tom had a full beard. Yet they were on a military installation in military quarters that said Captain McNair and Captain Atwater, but they didn't look anything like captains. Right? So that was interesting to begin with. But what I didn't know is that the Army, in the form of Stubblebine, had wanted the folks who had created the remote viewing research program out at Stanford Research Institute, which is hard to say clearly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and now known as SRI International. Anyway, they, Stubblebine, had wanted them to come up with a methodology that could be trained to military personnel who had never had any real experience with anything psychic. And essentially, he wanted a good way of turning people into remote viewers without it having to be trial and error as it had been up to that point. So I'm there, you know, just hanging out, doing my thing. And one day Tom and Skip knock on my door and they said, you know, we think you might be good at what we do. And I said, okay, what do you do? And they said, we can't tell you. So I said, how do I know whether I could do it or not? And they said, don't worry, take these tests. They gave me some psychology and personality profile tests and stuff. If you score what we think you will, we'll read you on. So as I've often said, this is kind of my Men in Black moment. I apparently scored where they thought I would. I'm taken over to these old ramshackle former temporary World War II buildings they were still using. Sat down in the back with Tom, and Tom says, our mission here is to collect intelligence against foreign threats using a parapsychology skill known as remote viewing. We're inviting you to volunteer to become a psychic spy. And interestingly enough, I thought they probably were into something weird, so I wasn't horribly surprised by this. In fact, it's like everything clicked. I said, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. and Tom says, well, no, wait a minute. You don't have to decide. You have 24 hours to let me know. I said, I don't need 24 hours. I want to do this. Absolutely want to do this. He was kind of shocked because nobody else had jumped on board that quick.
I think the term psychic spy would have been like the bait.
Well, it certainly got my attention. The job I was in was kind of boring anyway. But I don't care if it had been the most exciting other job in the Army. I'd have gone for this. a little quick background. So as a kid, I'd been very interested in ESP and science fiction and stuff, particularly ESP in science fiction. I was in a science fair project that totally failed, so I decided, no, there must not be anything to it, but it's still fun to read about. And now here's somebody telling me that the federal budget has money set aside to actually teach people how to do this. And my brain is saying, there's no way I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. When this offer is made to you, did you think you were qualified?
No, actually, I had a bit of worry about whether or not I could measure up. Obviously, I didn't really know what was entailed by it. I had never heard about it. I'd never done it. And I thought, well, you know, I hope I can do it. If I can't do it, well, then I'll just have to go back to pushing papers, you know, and all that. And in fact, just about every time I do a remote viewing session, I'm never quite sure it's going to work this time.
Okay.
So I always have this performance anxiety. It's gotten much less over the years. But back then it was pretty, pretty intense.
Well, and some of the interviews I've heard you talk about saying that you don't always know. And so there were cases where you actually had to get the result to understand that you were onto something, because there were so many times when there was absolutely no way you were going to find out if you were right or wrong.
That's right. The interesting thing about remote viewing is you can be absolutely sure you're on and you're not. You can be absolutely sure you're not and you are. And all the shades in between that. And it's because our conscious minds are the things that are thinking these thoughts. But it's our subconscious minds that are getting the data and hooking up to what we... And so our conscious minds never trust our subconscious minds, and they're always doubting them or whatever, and doubting it and everything. And you actually have to learn how to manage that in order to be successful as a remote viewer.
Well, I like the fact that there's also something called telepathic overlay, which would explain why sometimes you're on and yet not.
Yeah. So I don't like telepathic overlay myself.
No.
It messes things up. But yes, you're exactly right. You can actually be psychic and get accurate psychic impressions, but they're from the wrong thing. They're from what the person that maybe tasked you on a target thinks about the target. You pick up their thoughts rather than you pick up the actual data from the target itself. And that's always annoying when that happens.
One of the things I like is that you actually worked closely with Ingo Swann, and getting into some of this with the UAP, UFO stuff. Ingo was incredibly interested in that. He talks about it in the book Penetration. And of course, you know, there's some disagreement on whether everything in there is legit and what he might have alluded to. But he wrote it, I think, before some of this was declassified. So he had to be a little bit, I think, sort of just behind the scenes trying to give you hints and not full out say it to keep within his contract what he had obligated himself for. Does that make sense?
Yeah. In Penetration, I haven't actually identified any classified information except for probably the one instance, you probably recall this, where he was taken to somewhere up north, probably Alaska, and observed a what we would call a UFO or a UAP flying around the countryside. Mm-hmm. And he purposely brought up there by, probably authentic men in black, if you will.
Yeah.
And because they were hoping he could shed some light on what the thing was. And I think he tried to remote view it. And it's been so long since I read the book, I can't remember what the information he provided. But he was still a bit clueless as well. But that probably would have been classified at the time, I'm guessing.
My guess is it would. And the other thing, too, about that, my memory is that he was shot at, and they had asked him to help them identify something, and he had not anticipated being shot at, having his life threatened. And so his response was, the next time you do this, let me know in advance. I will not be able to give you any kind of psychic reading when I'm trying to, save my life. And that I'm paraphrasing, okay?
That could be right. That sounds familiar. We should make the point that he wasn't shot at by a bullet.
No, yeah.
It was some kind of energy weapon of some sort.
Yeah, it was shooting at all of them, not just him. He wasn't the only target. Yeah. He was just in the mix. Well, okay, so with that, though, with your association with him, then you also kind of got tagged for some other types of projects, including some that he did, that had to do with UFOs and UAPs. And with that, how did you feel? I mean, this is really on the fringe of what we were being taught, what we were allowed to speak of, and yet here you are being tasked with these projects, looking at the moon, looking at, are there UFOs, UAPs? And I'm guessing that was, digressing, that was Mount Hayes. I'm guessing that's where that was.
Well, there's a number of things to bring out here. So first off, let me think where to start. So first off, for example, I did remote view the moon. I was doing that as a project he invited me to contribute to, and that was a strictly civilian effort. That didn't have anything to do with the military. The Mount Hayes thing, and this takes us back to Skip's book.
Yeah.
So Pat Price, who unfortunately I never met, he died in 1975, and I didn't get into the program until 1983. Pat Price was a legendary remote viewer. He walked into the SRI project and volunteered to be a remote viewer. And he had some native skills that he developed as a police commissioner. And then apparently he did some police work. They talk about the blue sense, where a cop can often recognize danger and such without having any reason to believe there's danger there. And it turns out there is. They just have this sort of psychic intuition about it. Pat Price had that on steroids, and he did a lot of just regular ground truth kinds of things, stuff that really existed. For he remote viewed a Soviet R&D facility and accurately described what it was years before his information was confirmed. He turned out to be totally right about it, and in fact, after he was dead was when we first found out that he'd been right.
Wow.
So anyway, but he also had an interest in a number of other things, and one of which was UFOs, what we call today UAPs. And one day he comes in, and Dr. Harold E. Putoff, who is the co-founder of the program and the lead scientist, Pat comes in one morning to Hal's office and says, I just got bored last night, and I started looking around the planet for UFO bases. We can talk all about that. I'm not sure how we got that bug, but anyway, and I found four of them, and here's my notes. And he throws them on the desk, and Hal's kind of stunned and said, okay. And he asked a few questions like, where were they? And one was Mount Hayes in Alaska, one was Mount Pinatubo in the Pyrenees, I think it is. No, that's not right. That's in the Philippines. It's in the Pyrenees anyway, that mountain. I've forgotten now what it was. Mount Zeeland, Alaska, and then another mountain in Zimbabwe, I want to say, is where it was. I have these all memorized, but sometimes my brain doesn't go all the way to the top floor.
That's okay. We'll diagram them in the notes.
That's good.
And it's in the book.
So anyway, Hal has to contact the CIA. Anytime something strange happened in the program, he's required to contact his person at the CIA, and he told them about it. So these kind of just languished. They did get a little bit of confirmation about the Mount Zeal site, but nothing absolutely confirmatory. And then Hal provides copies of Pat Price's notes about this to Skip Atwater long about, I want to say it's probably around 1982 or so. And so you have to picture this. Skip's at Fort Meade, Maryland, which is on the East Coast, and Hal is in Menlo Park at SRI, which is on the West Coast. And so Hal sends these out to Skip. They don't really have any direct conversation about this, except maybe on the phone. Now, at least that's my presumption about it. Anyway, so Skip said, well, thinking, well, what can I do with this? And he thinks, I know, I'll get some of my viewers to work on this as a sort of, not just a one-off thing, but actually it's good training in a way, because viewers have to be off balance all the time. They can't always assume what kind of, in fact, they shouldn't ever assume what kind of targets they're going to be given. So Skip would often give us targets that had nothing to do with any military target or intelligence target, just to keep us off balance so that we wouldn't get caught in any ruts. Mm-hmm. Right? It's very important to do that. So we thought, well, this would be really great for that purpose. And he ran Joe McMonigle, who was probably the most famous of the viewers at Fort Meade, at least the most famous credible of the viewers at Fort Meade. He ran him on all four of the targets. And then he ran me, Mel Riley, let's see who else, Tom McNear, I think, Charlene Schufelt, and I want to somebody else. I'm blanking. There's a couple others. There was Joe, and then there were six of us. He ran the six of us just on Mount Hayes. And the remote viewing results that came from those sessions is the backbone of the book, Skip's book, Project 8200.
Okay, real quick. Here are the locations. The Mount Hayes, Alaska.
Yeah.
Mount Zell, Australia.
Yeah.
Mount Perdido, Spain.
Perdido, yes.
Okay.
I knew it started with a P.
Yeah, you were close, yeah. And then Mount, and I'm not, Inyangani, Zimbabwe.
Inyangani, yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Well, and
You understand why I couldn't remember that one.
Yes. It's kind of a tongue twister. Okay, so so those are the locations. I remember when they were trying to see, they weren't real sure that Pat, for one thing, that was a completely off the wall thing that he did when he came in and said, I was bored last night, so I did this. Mm-hmm. There was a phone call made to, I think, a military base or something in Australia. And when they said, well, do you know anything about this? Is this an unusual, anything about that we need to know about that? And they said, oh, you mean the one where the UFOs fly around?
Yeah.
So right on.
That's correct. Yeah. So I kind of glossed over that part of the story. So it actually was the CIA station chief in Australia. So Hal called up Kit Green, who was the contract monitor of the CIA, and he was on the weird desk, as the CIA calls it, where everything unusual and weird is so important at the CIA. He calls up Kit and says, Kit, you know, got this bat came in and told me all this stuff and this weird thing and these four mountains and all that stuff. He runs it. And Kit says, huh, well, I happen to know the station chief in Australia. So I'll just call him up, and without telling him why I'm calling, I'll just say, hey, what can you tell me about the Mount Zeal area? I'm not sure that's actually pronounced, but that's how it's spelled. And Mount Zeal area. And so Kip calls up this guy, and he says, yeah, what can you tell me about the Mount Zeal area? And the guy says, without any prompting, without any preliminary or anything, says, oh, you mean that place where all the flying saucers are always flying around?
Hmm.
And that seemed to be some kind of corroboration that Pat might be right about at least that particular place.
From what I read, and this is Project 8200, the original remote viewing transcripts with all of Pat's information, the diagrams, the pictures that he provides, the whole nine yards, these are detailed readings. This isn't just, you know, here's a target, here's something flying, and here's a mountain, and there's a location. This is what's happening in the mountain, where and what type of projects. And I like the one Mount Hayes seems to be really like a hub, and all sorts of shall we say, misadventures here for the U.S. and Russian military seems to be happening there and orchestrated at Mount Hayes. Now, that's one that you were involved in remote viewing.
Yeah, Pat said that was a maintenance base, and those of us who remote view it, for the most part, supported that claim. That doesn't mean it wasn't involved in other things. We do lots of maintenance in military bases where we also have fighter strike wings and stuff like that, you know. So, yeah, I was blind to it. I did not know what the target was, which is how you want the viewer to be. And I produced quite a bit of data that was consistent with it actually being having something to do with UFOs and, in fact, maintenance.
Yeah.
Interestingly, some of my sketches closely resembled the sketches in Pat Price's work. You know, Pat had done that back in
73.
Oh, shoot. 73, thank you. Yes.
73.
Back in 73. And I did mine in 1984. And I had never met Pat. I didn't even know that this remote viewing of alien bases had even ever been done. I was totally blind to this. I did not get a cave in my session, but I did report details that matched, including and I even got what we call analytical overlay, which is a mental noise input of flying saucer or UFO. I can't remember how I described it, but and that's because the sketch I made just looked so much like it. The particular one that I sketched that was very similar to Pat's looks very much like Tic Tac, as described by the Nimitz Group folks.
And you didn't find this out in what, till 2004?
Let's see. I didn't find out. Let me see, how did I find this out? I'm not remembering now how I came to awareness that that's what I'd remote view.
Well, from what I read, Skip held on to these. He held on to the paperwork, and it didn't get run up the chain. That's why he still was able to release it. And I think Hal Puthoff also had it. I don't know if Russell had it, but Russell Targ. It seemed like, and then you got the papers too, and Ingo would have still been alive at that time. He didn't pass until 2013. So were you able to run this by Ingo and say, hey, dude, what do you think?
You know, I did not. And when my mom died, after she was gone, I remembered all the questions I wanted to ask her and didn't occur to me to ask her, you know. And this was one it didn't occur to me to ask him, like, what do you think of this and all that. And in fact, he might have even had a conversation with Pat Price about this, because obviously there were contemporaries in the remote viewing program. A missed opportunity that maybe someday I'll get back, but I'm not in a hurry to.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you did stuff with Ingo, and that's one of the things that he also was connected to Pat Price. Pat, I thought there's a conspiracy, you know, the thing about Pat's death, which kind of goes along with John Mack and some other important people who somehow disappear under interesting circumstances. What I heard was that it was the case of a heart attack, and supposedly that was he was known to have had heart issues. But there's another element that the body disappeared on the way to the morgue. Okay. Has that ever been resolved?
Well, no, they never got to the bottom of that. What happened was Pat died in a hotel in Vegas. A ambulance shows up, loads the body, and departs. And there's this missing 24-hour gap between when that ambulance, nobody actually discovered whose ambulance it was. They just assumed that they knew what they were doing, right? Disappeared for 24 hours, and then the body just shows up in the morgue. That's the mystery here, is that missing time. And there's a couple of speculations. A lot of people want to blame the CIA on it, whatever. I really don't think the CIA was involved, because they had at that point employed Pat. They'd taken him away from SRI, offered him a lucrative position with the CIA, I think probably as a contractor, to remote view directly. They didn't have to go through SRI to get him to do it, because they were very impressed with his capabilities. You don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
No.
Right? It's silly to think the CIA did it. However, I was talking to one of Pat's daughters, and she said, the last time I talked to my dad was about 2 weeks before he died. He said, if anything happens to me, it's probably the KGB. They're out to get me.
That I'm not surprised about, because Ingo Swann's book, Starfire, The War to End All Wars, has begun. Okay, Ingo writes a fiction book, and there's so much information, so much interesting content in that about why you might want a body, why 24 hours might be helpful, especially if you're doing what the two who are opposed to each other, the U.S. and the Soviets, what they were doing at the time. And shoot, we took tips from them. That's I believe, what started the Stargate program. Was like, well, they're doing it, so we're going to do it now. And the one question that that I think Uri Geller says he was asked if he could stop a heart. If you do any research with the Asian martial arts and you watch them with their sound, chi, I believe is the way it's pronounced, and you watch somebody get debilitated with that particular move, then some of this stuff is really even more interesting than what you were doing.
It could be, if the KGB was involved and if they're responsible for the body being missing for 24 hours, I'm not going to rule out what you just said. But we do know that they had a habit of using this drug that mimics a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And it leaves very little trace in the body, but there is a little. And so an Occam's razor kind of a response here would be they could well have used that drug, but then whisked the body away long enough for it to essentially dissolve or whatever
dissolve.
It does in the body
and
bring it back. So the only evidence the CIA or anybody else could have was that it was a heart attack killed him, and he did have a history of heart trouble.
How convenient. Yes. But the whole thing about that is it shouldn't have happened. It's too coincidental. And so those kinds of things are fascinating. There's another, and this is off the topic of the book, but you mentioned in another interview about an incident in Australia, I believe, South America. And this was about a minesweeping boat that had an interesting experience. I believe from other stories I've heard that this is an area, and you don't have to back this up, but it's like an area that is similar to what is filmed in the movie The Abyss. There's a lot of UFO activity. It's USO underwater. And this story that you mentioned, I thought, was really relevant. I know it's got a specific name because of the area, but you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I don't know what they call it, but it's off the coast of Argentina, and it is famous for lots of USOs, undersea unidentified submerged object or something like that. The newer word is transmaterial.
Oh.
UFOs or UAPs.
Okay.
And I'll tell you a little story about that. It happened at Skinwalker Ranch here in a little bit if you want.
Oh, yeah.
But, this is kind of famous. The Argentinians have been tracking these things, tracking by observing them and reporting them to some degree, coming out of the water, going into the water, that kind of thing. And at one point, one of their minesweepers was found adrift. Nothing wrong with it. It's like if you're familiar with the old story of the Mary Celeste, which is a freighter that the crew just disappeared off of in no accountable way. Food on the table, coffee brewing in the galley, and just nobody there. So in this case, the same thing happened with this minesweeper. It was adrift, and it's just like people got up and walked away and then disappeared. It looked like everything was normal, except there weren't any people. So there was some reporting that from Argentina, I think, that it might have been. This was also Skip Outer project. I really need to kind of query him about this. But he targeted, I want to say, four of us. I know Joe was one of them. Bill Ray was another one. I was one. I don't remember who the fourth one was. It was either Tom or Charlene. Anyway, he targets us on this event, again, blind. I had no idea what it was. And Bill got some interesting stuff, as did Joe. Did I say Joe McMonagle? He was in on it.
Yeah.
Like the crew, you had Bill on here. He could tell you a really rip-roaring story about it. But the crew, like something came up out of the water, was hovering over. The crew went nuts and all jumped overboard. I want to say that's Joe's, that's what Bill came up with. I can't remember what Joe did. And me, I think I'm over much useful because right off the bat, I'm getting impressions of a ship and a UFO. And I'm going, because I thought this was just a normal project. I had no idea what it was. And I'm thinking, oh, this is just ducky. I'm getting all boogered up with this ship and a UFO, and I can't even do the real target. And it kept coming up, and I finally said, I quit. I can't do it. That just is occupying my brain. Mm-hmm. I really regret that today. I wish I'd just gone with it and just to see what happened. But, you know, I was trying to be a responsible viewer, and if you're just getting noise, then you have to take measures to get out of it, and quitting seems to be the logical case here. And yet I was on and didn't know it.
But that would be cognitive dissonance, because it was so far outside your comfort zone. You're like, nope, I'm not going there.
Yeah. Well, you could say that. It, in a modified sort of kind of a remote view and cognitive dissonance, where you're absolutely sure that that's just mental noise and you don't want to contaminate your session, so you just stop. And then it turns out it wasn't mental noise at all.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. But I do think that's a challenge as a remote viewer, that, you know, you're not always going to know. And sometimes when you feel like you're just totally crazy, that in order to save face and ego, it's easier to say, nah, this isn't my bailiwick, yeah. Whatever, you know, my bailiwick, whatever they call it. Yeah. Anyway, that's self-preservation.
Yeah. Which you've got to give up in remote viewing if you're going to be good. with my students, I tell them, you know, remote viewing is a very Zen-like thing. Zen in the sense, like, for example, in Zen archery, the goal isn't to hit the target. The goal is to do the process perfectly. It's a discipline thing. Knock the arrow perfectly, draw the bow perfectly, release the arrow perfectly. That's the goal, is to master the process. Right? And it's kind of a contemplative, meditative kind of a process. If you happen to hit the target, that's great. Well, in remote viewing, actually, you enhance your chances of hitting the target if you can let go of the need to hit the target. The more you worry about whether you're going to get it right or not, the more likely you are to be wrong.
It's control.
It's control of the process, not of the end state.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Some of these people who came into the program, like Pat Price, he just says, oh, look, this is what I got. There you go. See, bye. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no emotional attachment to it from
exactly.
My interpretation. It was like, I see mm-hmm. it. It's there. I can't make it go away. So here, deal with it.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah, he must. So it's in a way, it's a humility. You have to be humble enough that you don't have your ego driving you, insisting on success because, well, there's this Far Side cartoon I bring up all the time. So it shows the guy playing the cymbals in the back of the orchestra, right? Mm. And I think his name was Harvey. And you see the thought bubble over Harvey's head. He says, this time I'm not going to screw up. This time I'm not going to screw up. This time I'm not going to screw up. And the caption says, Harvey screws up, because he's been so busy focusing on not screwing up that he forgot to pick up the second cymbal.
Yes.
He only has one.
Yes. There is a guy who used to teach that. He would say, this is how you don't motivate someone. And he said, I'll show you how, but don't ever do it. And the thing is, if you've got a kicker and you're upset with the kicker and going out and saying, you shouldn't kick it like that, quit kicking it like that, stop kicking it like that, you're going to. And then what you should do is say, here's how you kick it. Here's how you kick it. Here's what you do. And, you know, instead of going forward, instead of pulling them back into the same motion over and over. It's the same message of, if you want somebody to do something, expect them to do it and show them how, or at least give them a tip and let them show you how it's done.
There's a well-known self-improvement technique, where if you fail at doing a task, you don't say, I can't do this, because that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You say, I haven't done this yet, or I need to master this, or I can master it. You send yourself a positive message and not a negative one, and that's a key here.
Now, this is, again, a diversion, maybe off topic, but when Pat Price, who that interesting death aspect, and others were remote viewing and obviously considered the enemy from the other side, did you ever feel like you were targeted?
Well, so Stargate, in all its various iterations before it was called Stargate, was one of the most deeply kept, it's a very highly classified program, let's put it that way. It's what's called a SAP, a Special Access Program. And at one time, only about 150 people in the entire world knew it existed. There's four levels. There was, when it was Center Lane, that's when the Army owned it, there was CL-1, CL-2, CL-3, CL-4. CL-1 was the lightest security designation. CL-4 was the heaviest. And CL-4 was largely identity and locations of the remote viewers, because they kept that the most secret. And the reason was, as far as we know, the only way of stopping someone from remote viewing your secrets is to take them out. And, of course, none of us wanted to be
eliminated.
Out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yes, that was highly classified. And so I didn't actually feel targeted ever, because I was comfortable that no one that might be wanting to do that had any idea who I was or where I was.
What about the ETs?
Well, You know, if they want to get me, there's not a damn thing I can do about it. So there's no point in worrying about it at that point, right?
I agree.
I think that they probably, you know, it's hard to say. I'm dubious that they would sort me out of the crowd, generally speaking, because it's very doubtful that you can detect a remote viewer. Now, you will hear people say that you can, but their evidence is pretty skimpy on that. There's plenty more evidence that people don't detect you remote viewing a particular site or whatever. So I'm not sure the aliens could know who the remote viewers are.
Okay, let me bring up the Ingo Swann. I don't remember if it was Mars or if it was the moon, where he felt like when he was looking at them, they were looking at him, and he shut down. He's like, "Hold,
yeah, that was the moon."
Okay,
yeah, that was the moon.
And you
and
did that.
In
you
fact,
go ahead.
Yeah, despite what I said, I did have one experience where I felt like some conscious entity at the target was aware that I was remote viewing it. I won't tell you the story at this moment, but I did not feel like it knew where or who I was. It just knew it was being targeted, or at least accessed, right?
Yeah.
And it was disturbed by that, but it didn't feel like it could do anything about it. So I don't, I'm resistant to a lot of the claims that people make about being perceived at the target as the remote viewing by somebody or something at the target, because I think a lot of them are just fantasy or imagination. But I can't totally rule out the possibility that that can happen, that somebody or something at a target can perceive a remote viewer. But I think that's quite a rare thing, and I think it's whoever is perceiving that or whatever is perceiving that at the target has to be pretty consciously advanced in some respect to be able to detect that.
Well, and my thought in terms of it didn't mind, it knew that it couldn't stop it, or that you weren't a threat.
Well, my perception was, and that's all I can say, I can't guarantee it's true because I didn't have no evidence for that, you know, provable objective evidence. But my experience with it was that it knew I was there, it didn't know whether I was a threat or not, but it couldn't do anything about it because it had its own thing and it was doing it, and it couldn't deviate from that.
Ah.
So I'll tell you the story. You want to hear the story
now? Yes, of course. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if you wanted it now or later. So Ingo calls me up one day and says, "Hey, Paul, would you help me with a remote viewing project?" And I said, "Okay." I always said okay to Ingo, except when I disagreed with him, then we had arguments. But I said okay. I enjoyed doing projects with him. He sent me some coordinates, latitude and longitude, and I didn't think anything special about this because we use coordinates as targeting methods oftentimes at Fort Meade. And I, of course, just assumed that they were earthly coordinates. So I come in on this target, at, you know, those coordinates, and I start noticing that this is really quite weird. There's these really sharply defined rocks and hills and mountains, and there's rings of debris, and hey, I can't breathe. It's like there's no air here. Mm. At that point, based partially on my sketches, I realized, he's put me on the moon. How dare he? So, anyway, the way this session unfolded is I perceived an underground cavity, and I'm talking huge. It was part engineered and part natural. So it's as if somebody come along, found this underground cavity that suited their purposes, and enlarged and finished it, you know, smoothed it out and everything. And essentially it was quite large. And inside of this, there were these various things. And as I'm there, I get the perception of something coming up out of the cavern through an opening in the surface of the moon. And it was kind of a manta ray shape. That's the best way I can describe it. So kind of unibody with wings sticking out. It didn't have a stingray tail, but, you know, it's kind of shaped like a manta ray, a kind of bulge in the middle. And as it's coming out, I'm perceiving it, and I had this feeling that the thing was, you know, an artificial construct like any flying vehicle would be, but that there was a biological organic component to it as well. It was like it was a fusion of regular material, inorganic material, and also biology. And as I went along, and I should point out here, this is before the second iteration of Battlestar Galactica. This was before Stargate Atlantis. And both of those, of course, TV series had combination organic and artificial spacefaring vehicles. But this was well before that, and I had no inkling of anything like this. So in some respect, I kind of feel like there's missed something to that because I would not have guessed it. I would not have speculated on something like that. It just kind of popped into my head unbidden. And so anyway, I have this impression of this biological artificial thing. And as I'm trying to tease information out, trying to think, you know, understand this better, I had the impression it was recognizing that I was there and I was examining it. And that's when I had the feeling it was irritated by that. It found that annoying. It sounded kind of like an invasion. But again, it couldn't do anything about it. It didn't have as much volition as I did. It couldn't choose to deviate from where it was, what its intended purpose was. I think, I've never expressed it that way, but as I think about it, I think that's really what it was. And then it went off. You know, when I say flying, technically I guess it wasn't flying because there's no atmosphere on the moon, but it was propagating through space in some way. But that was very interesting. I drew a quite compelling sketch of it. And, you know, I don't know to this day if it was real or made up, but it really had the feeling of being real, despite what I said earlier. Every once in a while you have this sense that something might be correct, and it turns out it is. It had the feeling of being real until I get some, you know, hard data, check it out. And this was on the backside of the moon, so we got to land somebody over there to find out.
To find it. Okay. Now let me give you a different perspective in terms of what you saw. The stuff from Kenneth Arnold's daughter, which she's beginning to say or has recently said in media interviews, is that her father was misquoted. He said what he saw was skipping along like a disc, and it was misquoted as a flying a saucer, a disc. Mm. And what he has said and wasn't released earlier because he thought he would be labeled crazy for absolute certainty, he saw something that was shaped like a manta ray and seemed like it was biological.
I did not know that.
I just thought, oh my gosh, what you're describing is what is now, and this has just been recent in the past 5-10 years, that he did not want to say that because You know, he's a pilot. He wants to be able to do his job. And so
he don't want to lose his
license.
Authorization to fly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what the daughter is saying.
Well, and I don't remember how long I've been telling this story. I've told it a few times in various venues, but I'm pretty sure it has been more recent than 10 years.
That, I just think, considering what you're saying and the description that his daughter offers, that's really a unique similarity. That's really specific. So it'll be interesting. I mean, we haven't been to the dark side, the backside of the moon, or at least they're now showing the anomalies that are there that they hadn't been discussing before. And that gives you just a little bit of hope.
Then we'll get more information eventually.
That'll eke it out. Well, and you know, there's a lot of discussion about what should be public knowledge and you know, and then continue to be held classified. And a lot of the Stargate stuff, as I understand it, there's still a lot of stuff that remains classified.
Well, yeah, there might be. So you're talking about Stargate in general, the Stargate archives?
In general, yeah.
Yeah. So what they appeared to have done was, when Congress turned the remote viewing program over to the CIA, the CIA went to the Fort Meade facility and just emptied the safe drawers there, the files there, and declassified those. So there's chunks of information and data that aren't in there. For one thing, the scientist that took over the program from Hal Puthoff when Hal moved on, somebody funded him with his own physics lab, and that was an offer he couldn't refuse because it was his dream come true that he got his own physics lab.
Mm-hmm.
He'd do any research he wanted. So Hal moved on in 1985, and Ed May inherited the program, took it over, and ran it then for the next 10-ish years. Ed had a bunch of data, a ton of data, that at SRI and for a year, I think, or so at SAIC, where the program moved eventually. He had a ton of data that didn't get hoovered up by the CIA. And so that stuff, some of it duplicates what the CIA got from Fort Meade. Some of it is stuff that isn't in there. And Ed May has published 4 volumes. Stargate Archives or something like that, which include the data that he had. They were kind of pricey. They're like $100 a book. But there's a lot of good stuff in them. But even that doesn't amount to everything that he's got. Now, he's donated a bunch of his archives now to Rice University, and so maybe the bulk of what he's got is in there. But it's hard to say. The government basically did want to wash its hands of this. People say, well, the CIA is still doing it. I don't think that's true. That at the time that Congress pushed the program over to the CIA, it was led by a director who did not want to have anything at all to do with remote viewing. He made that very clear throughout his career. So this isn't just a story that is told to say that the CIA got rid of the program, but it's still hiding somewhere. The director at the time absolutely hated remote viewing and wanted nothing to do with it. So I am certain that the CIA did, in fact, terminate any remote viewing program they were doing. So the government doesn't want to do it, and they were happy to, well, in fact, they sort of painted themselves into a corner. Because if they didn't declassify all the information associated with it, then people would think, maybe there is something to the program, and then they're only declassifying the stuff that doesn't matter to make you think that they had ended the program. Now, I think they had incentive to declassify everything that didn't involve other sources and methods that compromise other intelligence collection means. But there is a possibility that the NSA has a program still. They had some folks in training the same time I and my colleagues were in training with Ingo, so they had a program. I've heard since hints and rumors that they still have it. Do they? I don't know, but at least there's a chance they may still be using remote viewing themselves. But you can pretty much be sure that the military services are out of it. And the CIA probably is, although there's maybe a 10% chance they've still got something going on. But there's a little bit better chance that NSA is doing it. So,
well, those guys that escorted Ingo Swann to Alaska had to come from somewhere.
Yeah, and that's an interesting situation. And I don't know. Well, of course, that was before the program was closed, too. Mm-hmm. That happened then. I want to say that probably happened in the late 70s, early 80s. I don't know that he put a date on it. I'm not remembering that he put a date on it. But I think that's probably what it was. Of course, the program was still going at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't remember the date either. It doesn't necessarily mean that they were affiliated with anybody known.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, there could be. Well, as we know from like David Grushin and Jay Stratton and these folks, that there are a lot of things going on, SAPs and stuff like our program was going on. I say a lot. I don't know what a lot really means here, but where there is definitely stuff that the government hasn't yet revealed. And so that could have been one of those that guy was from, right, all we know.
What was similar, and again, digressing, Lou Elizondo's coming out with his version of what's going on, and it kind of dovetails with Ingo Swann in terms of the NHI, non-human intelligences, really don't have our best interests at heart, that we might not be their favorite pet.
And Ingo, in fact, thought that they were afraid of us. He thought that the whatever they are, NHIs is a good term because it doesn't commit you to anything, right? Mm. That they felt that our capacity for projecting consciousness was greater than theirs. And so Ingo was convinced that they were intervening in human affairs, not for all the speculative reasons that people at various UFO conferences think, but because they were trying to inhibit our development of our consciousness abilities for fear that we would surpass them and that we would end up being their masters instead of the other way around. So it certainly is a thing to think about.
In view of having the ability to be telepathic, it is a secret superpower.
Yes, even if you're known to have it, it's still a secret superpower because nobody can see it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people who do it don't always let you know that that's what they're doing, and that's the way you stay in power.
Oftentimes, if they do let you know that they're doing it, then they aren't really doing it.
It's a control. It's a control.
Yeah. We all know that they are looking for attention or whatever, and so they're making it up. Or don't even know they're making it up, but they are.
Usually if you want a secret superpower, it has to say secret. It's just like, don't tell anybody. You can't use it. And then they avoid you. You don't have access the same way that you might have before. With remote viewing, though, with the four alien bases and you being involved in this, and I think I'm really glad to see that he has put this out so at least it's available for people to make up their own minds on what might be happening. But when you realized that you were part of this project, what's the takeaway?
Well, there's the cliche, we're not alone, right? That may not be the takeaway you're looking for. In my case, it made me more open to all these possibilities. So I've always believed in NHIs. Well, they might be human too, at least anyway, intelligence on other planets. And I like to tell folks, and which is true, that I belong to the only Christian denomination that believes as a point of doctrine that there's intelligent life on other planets. That's the so-called Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We actually have a tenet in our doctrine that specifies that God peopled many, many worlds in our universe with people, with intelligent people. So I didn't have a problem accepting that premise, but were they visiting us or not? And I don't know. I didn't know. I was a bit agnostic on that question. This has made me more inclined, the remote viewing part made me more inclined to accept the possibility. And of course, with the Nimitz and all of these, there was the Tic Tac and all these other events in which we have really, really good evidence that they're real. That, of course, then confirms me in that suspicion. It's no longer a suspicion. It's a conviction that this stuff is, at least some aspect of it is real. And I like to tell folks, 10% of what you hear is about UFOs is probably true, and 90% is just baloney.
Okay. My question, and you've answered this kind of before when you said you can't block a remote viewer. Well, psychic attack, which is real, and I believe it is. I felt it. So like, okay, I'll just explain it real quick. Went into a place that the person had died, and my husband said, hey, go in there and check and see if the place is for sale. Unknowing that this is what was going on, the relatives had gathered, they were going through the dispersing of certain things. We thought it was an open house. I go in, immediately I'm hit in with a headache and really, it took about 4 hours for me to get rid of this thing, knowing the woman was absolutely really, really angry because I was interrupting her gathering with her people. I took notice and left, but just that's a psychic attack. How do you, as you teach controlled remote viewing, do you ever address that this kind of activity is possible when you're remote viewing and you are seen? Because this is what Ingo Swann describes having to deal with for till the end of his life, according to his niece, that was one thing he couldn't shake was getting targeted himself. Can you address that?
That's interesting. I don't usually, I have never had that experience myself. And nor most of my credible colleagues. I have some incredible colleagues.
Yeah.
I don't believe. Yeah. But most of us have not had that kind of experience. Now, Bill Ray tells a story. Bill was actually, he trained with me and Charlene and Ed Dames came along with us. And then he became commander of the unit because the lieutenant colonel we had got reassigned somewhere else. And so Bill, since he was a senior officer there, became the commander. So that's one thing a feather he has in his cap. But Bill was tasked, and this was by Ed Dames, we were all tasked on the Lost Ark, Ark of the Covenant. And Bill comes in on this target, and there's some kind of a container thing there, and he perceives these entities that were just, Bill tells the story way better than I do, but they're very implacable. They were totally emotional. In other words, they had no emotions whatsoever. They didn't hate, they didn't love, they didn't care. They just had a job to do, and Bill comes in, and they recognize him as an intruder, and they essentially tell him to get the hell out of there or going to blow him up. Well, they blow him up. I don't know what he said. Like he would just suddenly cease to exist or something. And he quickly got out of the session. That made quite an impression on him. So from that perspective, I trust Bill. I've never had that kind of experience, so I don't rule out the possibility, but I also don't think it's a common thing as long as you're minding your own business.
The minding your own business, when I interrupted, inadvertently interrupted a place that was, in that moment, a sacred space, that was my bad. You know, I think it had more to do not with targeting me as you know, it was an intentional thing because I had overstepped my bounds and I shouldn't have. So it was basically
unintentionally. You did not know you were doing something you shouldn't do, or you wouldn't have done it.
No, yeah. No. And if I went back, I think I would have been hit harder.
Yeah. Well, probably because at that point it would have been intentional.
Uh-huh. Yeah. If you're stupid, you're okay. You get a pass. But when you do it with intent, then it's like, oh, all bets are off. Yeah. And that's why they said, we'll blow you up or whatever they said. It's like, okay, this is your first warning.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially,
With this, do you think there's more belief in the fact that we are not alone?
You mean with the latest revelations from the government?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of folks now who might have doubted before now are convinced. And a lot of people who are already convinced now feel like they've been vindicated. Now, the diehard skeptics haven't changed their minds on this. You know, you're messing with their worldview, and they're not going to admit any of this until they just absolutely have to. Because that's what they do. I mean, everybody has a worldview, and anytime it's threatened, we're going to come up with reasons to keep a hold of the worldview and reject the threat. That's what skeptics are doing. But I think the balance has shifted quite a bit in the direction of these are real things. Now what do we do? And that's what we're still sorting out. There's all kinds of people who say all kinds of things, some of which might be true, but a large percentage of which are not. Just because it's associated with the UFO or UAP topic doesn't mean that what's being said is necessarily real or legitimate.
Yeah.
And that's a caution everybody has to take. You know, due diligence before you believe anything. The beauty of the government revelations, particularly the Nimitz incident, is that it has been really well vetted. That's evidence that is real. I've had skeptics try and rebut it, and they do not know what they're talking about. If there's anything in the world that's real, it was what happened to the Nimitz carrier group, you know, as they were observing this object from various information collection streams.
Mm-hmm. So you teach remote viewing, and that's still, mm-hmm. You also teach dowsing, or there was a program on your website with dowsing, and at one point you were involved with the Dowsers Association, and I think that's fantastic. Yeah. My mom's a dowser, has been for decades. So for anybody who wants to learn.
Well, I would say a good place to start that's accessible to everybody is to get my book. It's The Essential Guide to Remote Viewing. It's really the only one out there like this. It's designed as an introductory work to remote viewing that's accessible to anybody. I tried to write it at a level where most people can capture, you know, fairly complex concepts in some cases. So it's useful to somebody who's just learning about it. It's available on Amazon. Again, The Essential Guide to Remote Viewing. It's also useful for people who are involved in remote viewing and have family or friends who think they're nuts and want to help their family or friends understand that this isn't as crazy as it sounds. The book is written in a very non-sensational way. I have a lot of friends who like to sensationalize remote viewing. In this case, it's just the facts, man. You know, essentially that old Joe Friday thing. It's still interesting. I tell some of the really intriguing stories about what they did with it, but I also talk about what we know about how it works. I talk about how you can do some basic remote viewing experiments yourself. If you've never had the experience, it'll tell you how you can do that at a basic level. It talks about some of the skeptical arguments against it and the responses to that. And I talk about if you want a teacher, the qualification you want to look for if you're going to get a teacher. Oh, and so on and so forth. It's got a little bit of everything. And the reason that the book itself is kind of based on all the questions I've been asked over the years, and I've sort of put the answers to those questions in the book. So that's probably the best way to start. Now, for people who want to get beyond that, there's my website, which is the letter R and the word viewer. So that's rvieweer.com. I have a bunch of free information on there, but I also talk about my training program, and you can look into what I offer in my courses. Just to say, though, I'm probably not going to be teaching anything until the new year. I've got to go in November for shoulder surgery, and that's going to put me out of commission for a while.
Okay. No fun. No.
No.
Well, the other book is Reading the Enemy's Mind.
Yes. And I recommend that too, but that's a bigger read. It's 500 pages long, I think, which is not bad, and if you really want to learn about remote viewing. I cover where remote viewing came from, what happened while it was around, and the aftermath of it. In the process, I actually talked a lot about what it is and even a bit how to do it. But the book is really intended to tell the story of remote viewing and my involvement in it. And as I was saying, my involvement is really kind of the skeleton, the framework on which I hang the story of remote viewing. People seem to really like it, and that's not just me soliciting compliments or anything. I've had people I didn't even know come up and say, man, I loved your book. So, and that's also available on Amazon. Unfortunately, now you can get used copies of it, hard copy, but it's Kindle is how it's still in publication. So.
Okay. Excellent. Is there anything you want to add?
I think I've exhausted everything just I can say this afternoon. So, except the beauty of remote viewing is that it provides objective evidence that we really are more than just our brains, that humans are capable far more than just what physical scientists claim we are capable of. And remote viewing is really, really strong evidence for that.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Links are in the description for the show. Thanks for listening.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.